Problems choosing your ESPN fantasy football lineup? IBM Watson can help. Fantasy research can be overwhelming. That's why IBM Watson analyzes millions of expert fantasy football sources to give you smart, useful insights on every player. Visit IBM.com/fantasyfootball to find out more.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars, yelling, give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. This is our time of week where we do interviews. And this week we have, I guess, I don't even know how you describe this, the co-author perhaps of The Beautiful Ones. The author, I guess, is Prince Dan Pippenbring. I got it right?
You did.
Woohoo! I feel good about myself.
Thank you.
And he wrote, this is Prince's memoir that I guess a lot of us have waited our whole lives to get, and the book is out now, so be sure to go check that out. Mm-hmm. And the story behind you writing this book or working with Prince on this is one that I think a lot of people find to be interesting because you are 29?
I was then. I'm 33 now.
All right. You're 29 years old and we start this. How did you become the guy to write the book with Prince?
Well, it started in 2015, November, I think. I'm a writer who's done very little writing in my life, as is true, I guess, of most 29-year-olds. And I do have a literary agent, though, and he lets it slip that word is that Prince wants to write a book. And I've been a Prince fan forever, so we were out getting drinks, and I pretty much reached across the table and grabbed him and said, I have to help if I can. And he's like, okay, I'll put you up for this co-writing job. You're not going to get it. You've never written a book. That tends to be pretty disqualifying when you have to help someone else write a book.
And not just anybody, but like this
one. Yeah, one of the most special people to have graced the earth. And as it turned out, so they sent Prince a list of potential co-writers. And being the man that he was, he crossed off everyone who had written a book before. He did not want anyone who had a set template about what a memoir could be, what a book could be. And of course, he was always a huge mentor and nurturer of talent. And I think he wanted that to be the case here, too. He wanted to work with someone new. So it ended up just being me and a few other people on that list who had never written books before. And he asked us to write personal statements about him, why we thought we could do the book, what we admired about him. I sent mine in the same day I got the assignment, and 48 hours later, I was on a plane to Paisley Park, and that's how it all started.
I just can't imagine what that has to be like in that 48-hour time period. Because, like, for me, I remember when Jon Stewart left The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. I called my agent and said, they're not going to give me that job, but I want you to call over there and let them know, just in case somebody over there was like, hey, you know, I like that guy, right? Yeah. But let them know that I am interested in this job. And then 2 days later, apparently this was already in the works. It was never going to happen in the first place. But for you, 2 days later, they're like, hey, how'd you like to come to Paisley Park?
I know. I still can't really believe that it happened. And so that puts us in late January. And I had assumed that when I met with Prince, I would be surrounded by his aides and, you know, maybe various admirers, people fanning him, feeding him grapes, etc. But it was just he and I there for this meeting in Paisley Park. And night had already fallen, so my first view of the place, it was lit up purple. And that's really the only way I could tell what it was, because when you drive past it, it's in Chanhassen outside of Minneapolis. And it looks fairly unremarkable. It looks like a factory or like an office park or something. But it is where Prince lived.
I've never been to Minneapolis in general, but Paisley Park in specific.
Yeah.
And I've got this thing. I went to Paris I was in Paris when Prince died. Like, I found out. I went over there for some work.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, I actually found out before the world did because somebody let me know. You know, it's just like, wow, I'm in this, like, totally different place. But it dawned on me when I was in Paris where I looked around at all the architecture and I was like, yo, the 1500s and the 1600s were a great time to run the world, right? Like, the architecture is bomb. Like, you had all this money at a great time to do these things. Prince got that money in the 80s, and that is a poor time in architecture for you to hit your lick because you are going to be at best at the height of 80s architecture, which is like, it's like Miami's the same way. Like, all this got cracking in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah.
And it's ugly 60s, 70s, and 80s architecture.
I know. I have kind of a soft spot for it, the boxiness, the aluminum panels. It was like their idea of the future at that time.
I say, you two are always preparing for nuclear war, right?
Yeah.
That's what all of this is, like narrow windows and everything else. Like, all of that is the specter of nuclear war. nuclear war.
It is, yeah. It's a bunker mentality. And Paisley sort of has that. It doesn't have many windows. It's people compare it to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory sometimes. First of all, just because, you know, how would you get inside the gates? But right. Second, because you couldn't really tell what was going on there at right. any given time.
Well, yeah. One thing that it struck me as I was reading the book, and which I really enjoyed, and I recommend that people check it out, not just for Thank the novelty you. Of it, but I really thought that your portion to start explaining everything about how you get to this place, you know, to actually writing the book with him, I thought it was really interesting. And of course, he made you wait.
Yes, yes, yeah. I was waiting at the Country Inn and Suites in Janhassen. Shout out to them. They did great work. Great continental breakfast, really top notch. And yeah, there's never really a meeting time set with Prince. You're sort of on his clock. So I was just pacing my room, you know, sipping mint tea. I remember, you know, texting my girlfriend, like my outfits, like which one should I wear? And then finally his driver shows up and takes you there just sort of on a moment's notice though. So you go from being like, well, I guess I could be waiting here for 10 days to being like, okay, it's happening now.
Right.
And suddenly when it's happening, you're like, actually, I need more time. I would prefer to be waiting longer. But I remember sitting on my hands to try to warm them up, mindful of the fact that I would soon be shaking his. All of that anxiety, of course, is justified. But when you meet him, he's such a solicitous, generous, thoughtful guy. He really is an expert at putting people at ease. And my first impression of him was just of such a gentle man, a gentleman, one might say. He really did so much to make me feel like I didn't have to be freaking out in his company, that he was there to talk and that he wanted us to have a very open conversation.
I thought he could have done better by you than the Country Inn and Suites, though. Like, it appears to just be the thing that's around the corner, so that's where he puts everybody up.
Yeah, exactly.
But I did think that he could have got you a hotel that didn't have the heating unit over there in the corner with the grates on top.
I don't know. I mean, options are limited in Janhassen. It's right there.
I guess that's also the good thing about hiring the 29-year-old writer.
Yeah,
right?
That's
like
true.
Me at 39, like the writer that's written some books and stuff like that, like, man, this Prince got me staying in.
Yeah, yeah. I need the W or bust. Yeah, I'm still, even for this whole tour for the book, you know, any hotel, I'm like, all right, this is nice. They could put me in a Motel 6 and I'd be like, oh man, there's a TV in here. That's amazing. I got basic cable. I don't have that at home.
So for you, like starting the process of interviewing Prince and trying to figure out where you wanted to go with this, and plus he obviously had his own ideas. So I just wonder for you, like, what was your starting place? Like, okay, I'm doing Prince's memoirs. This is what I think I'd like it to be.
Yeah. I mean, I tried to go in with no preconceptions because I knew that he was going to want to do something that whatever my predictions would be, it would be utterly against them. And I knew too that he was kind of fickle about these things and mercurial, and someone who had done so much work to build a mystery around his persona that he could kind of turn his back on this book at any time. So my goal going in was just to keep him talking about anything he wanted to talk about. And I knew that he would be kind of shy, that he had kind of portrayed himself sort of shy conversationally. So I just thought, whatever I can do to get him opening up and just talking about whatever it is that crosses his mind that he thinks I need to know, that's what it has to be. So I wasn't trying to direct him too pointedly on any subject or to try and fence him in about things. I just wanted to hear the sound of his voice, which is a beautiful voice, by the way. His speaking voice is so kind of solemn and low, and it's also got this mischief in it, like everything he does. So yeah, that was my only goal going in there.
Well, after reading the book, I found it interesting that he, you know, hearing you now saying how at ease he was, because one thing he mentions in the handwritten portions in the book is about how it's hard for him to feel at ease if there's not a woman in the room.
Yes.
Like, it's almost kind of a surprise after reading that and seeing this that he did not choose a woman to write this book.
I know. That's another, it's another thing. You know, people ask me all the time, why did he choose you? And I really don't know. I was never given an explicit answer. But I think it goes back to that sense of unpredictability. And I was thinking about how, do you remember when he went on New Girl, the Zooey Deschanel show?
Yes.
It's like he could have gone on any show and he picked that one and it was perfect for him. But I think everyone's like, wait, really? Like, that's the show? And I think when we would talk about how it was me that he chose, he would kind of snicker a little bit. And I think that sense of mischief was there too. He's like, people are going to be like, why is it you? And I think the mere fact that they were going to be asking that question kind of tickled him or kind of delighted him. So that all plays into it.
Did that make you nervous, the idea that people would be wondering how the hell is this guy the one who's writing the book?
Of course. It still makes me nervous. I mean, I'm so fortunate that he chose me. It's been the honor of my life. But I think everyone's right to ask questions and be like, what's going on there? Like, what happened? Because he puts his trust in you. He confers this trust and you don't really know how it's going to work out. It's still kind of astonishing to me that all he required in the way of a background check, and I think I write this in the introduction, was like a really long conversation with someone. He was not going to be asking you for references or your resume or anything like that. He just wanted to know you. I think that's the only way to conduct yourself if you're someone of his status, but it's a lot. It's a burden, I think, if you're 29 years old and just getting your sea legs.
And the flip side, it's kind of fun being somewhere you ain't got no business being. Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because on one level, that can be a very intimidating idea. On the other, it's like, yo, I'm working with house money here.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would feel like a sort of fly on the wall wherever I was. And especially that first night in Paisley, I remember after our first conversation, I went back and I was just among the crowd because he was having a concert there that night. And just to be in that room and know that I had just talked to him, but that now I was just among the concert goers was a really thrilling feeling. And then his bodyguard and best friend, Kirk, came up to me and was like, hey, are you Dan? It's like, well, how do you even know who I am? Like, he just had a way of making you feel special even when you were one in the crowd.
So the interview process with him, you said he was very open and he was very good with things. Was there anything that you found that you tried to talk to him about that he wouldn't talk about?
Maybe not directly. He could be very discursive and kind of stream of consciousness. So you would ask him a question. If I would ask about, say, his parents or about why he chose to release an album in a newspaper, he would start on that for maybe like 10 seconds and then soon you would be off onto something else. And I think I wouldn't say that he was evasive. It's just that his mind seemed to be working so quickly and there were always things that if he had a moment to think that he would kind of return to, like change of distribution, the record industry's exploitation of black artists. There were things that he so clearly wanted to get down in the book that almost automatically he would beat a path back to them in conversation no matter where you were. As I said before, my goal was always just to keep him talking. So I never tried to be like, okay, that's great, but really let's get back to your parents. Because all of that was so new to me and it was never like he was repeating himself. He always had more to say on the subject. So he was really fun to talk to, just so thoughtful, so fiercely smart, and really funny too, which is something I try to bring across in the book. And of course, his own pages, I think, definitely do that. But in conversation, he could even give you like a little glance or something, and he could just crack you up just by looking at you.
And I can't imagine myself having the courage to be like, okay, Prince, that stuff you're talking about is cool, but let's get back to this.
Let's wrap it up.
Yeah. Like, I feel like I would just be sitting there with my hands on my cheeks like this and just being like, no, tell me more. Like, I just want to hear this. And I'm actually glad it worked out for you because people have asked me for years. I'm a Prince devotee in a way that you are. And they were just like, would you want to meet Prince? I'm like, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'd be afraid that this could go left and then this would taint how everything went.
I know.
Like you got the complete opposite experience.
I did. Yeah. I mean, they say you should never meet your idols, although I think he would really, he would have an aversion to that word, idol. He, of course, had a very fastidious use of language, and anything that verged on religious in a secular environment, he would be like, no, no. But yeah, I met him, and it really only improved my opinion of him. And he told me that he wanted to write a lot of books, and I think he absolutely would have done that had he lived. He was really discovering this new medium for him and seeing all the things it could do that his music couldn't do and how it could kind of coexist with his music. And when you're in the room with someone that creative and watching him kind of figure it out in real time, I mean, that's just the greatest feeling. The sense of potential energy, like just the crackle and spark coming off of him is just so special.
You mentioned just a couple seconds ago about he wanted to talk about like the exploitation of black artists is one thing he went to. I did find it interesting that you mentioned in the book that for Prince, that seemed to want to be, he wanted that to kind of be the central theme. Like race is out front of this book.
Yeah, of course. Another reason it's surprising that he chose me. You know, as a white guy who had no inkling of what it must have been like for him. But yeah, he really felt that from the start. He and all black artists had been kind of unfairly siloed by the music industry. Of course, he had had his protracted fight with Warner Brothers in the 90s, where all of that really came to a head, and he wrote Slave on his face. And he felt that if he could relay his own life story in a way that made people aware of everything he had had to do to surmount that and to become a global phenomenon where no one was trying to tell him how to live his life, make his music, put out his art, that he would really have accomplished something beyond the confines of just an autobiography. He almost wanted it to have a self-help component for creatives, and that would be the beautiful ones of the title. And of course, it reminds you of the lines from the song, Paint a Perfect Picture, bring to life a vision in one's mind.
You know, and there's so many parts you're just like, man, I wish we could have gotten to the end, because we were I think it was 4 months into this process.
Not even three, yeah.
When he passed away. And race is interesting also, because like, if you go talk to Alexander O'Neill would tell you Prince was only black when Prince wanted to be black.
Yeah, of course.
You know, there was the telling press for the longest that he had a white parent because that was what was necessary for him to get into the spaces.
That's right.
That he wanted to get into in order to push his music. You know, so I am fascinated when I read this and hearing, and I think also because he's from a town like Minneapolis that doesn't have a lot of black people. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting for me, at least it was in the handwritten stuff, to hear him talk about like the black church and going to these places and who the girls were that he was dating at the time, because it doesn't sound like what we saw in the 80s and early 90s in particular.
Yeah. And I think that's one reason he wanted to get it all down. He was thinking that a lot of people were reading Purple Rain as this kind of autobiographical story, and he knew that it wasn't that, that it was a dramatization in part meant to break him out to a new audience. He was very cunning about that kind of thing. And as you said, sometimes, you know, maybe misleading even. And I think he was like, well, that's not how it went down, and I need to pay my respects to this community that made me. People talk about me like I'm some kind of alien that just appeared on Earth. But I'm someone who came from a specific time and place. I had parents who made me who I was. I had a community, a black community in North Minneapolis that inspired me to get into music. And we were all just steeped in it, listening to everything, hanging out in the record stores, having this kind of one-upsmanship where who was the better guitarist? Who was the better bassist? Who was the best drummer? You know, you had to be on top of your game. And I think he brings all that across so wonderfully in those pages. His memories are so acute. It's like he had this well that he could just keep going back to and dredging up more stuff.
And he had this father that was a musician, right? Like, that was another thing after a point that I wish we would have been able to hear a bit more about, because I've always wondered for him. Your dad wanted to make it. Like, Joe Jackson and his kids are a great example, and how that can manifest itself in some weird ways. But at least Joe was, like, pushing his kid's career. You could say he had his hands on it or whatever it is. I always wonder what his life of John Nelson, where your son became this guy.
Yeah, I'm sure there must have been so much tension there. And it seems like, I mean, I'm only speculating, but it seems like for a while maybe their relationship wasn't as good as it ended up being toward the end of his father's life. But yeah, I mean, to be a band leader in your own right and to be working at the Honeywell factory during the day and just trying to make ends meet, and really, I get the sense too that John Nelson's jazz was not your typical, you know, snap your finger on the 2 and 4 kind of stuff. It was pretty out there. And the simultaneous triumph and resentment that comes with seeing your son succeed where you were not able to, I think there's so much to unpack there. And I did wonder about it.
Now, was there anything that Prince hit you with that really, like, you just remember stood out that it surprised you to hear? Maybe surprised you that he said it, or surprised you that it was even there to be said?
That's a good question. I mean, he talked about how there were going to be bombshells in the book, and, you know, really, because he didn't live long enough to get to those bombshell moments, the things that end up standing out to me are almost the more quotidian kind of domestic things. So, like, reading about his first kiss with Laura Winnick, you know, and saying that they were the youngest interracial couple in Minneapolis, that really surprised me. It's just so many things like that. His epilepsy and how he felt that he could just sort of stop it, and that there was one moment where he's like, I don't want to do this anymore, and that he had that kind of self-control. Or even the way we would talk about how his house felt coded for him, his childhood home, and he would look at the wallpaper and kind of see these patterns in it, and his mind was working overtime. I mean, all of that really basic boyhood, almost coming-of-age stuff, he seemed to remember so vividly that it did surprise me, because those were always the kind of blank spots in most people's story of Prince. And He had it all in his head. I remember him pointing to his head and being like, yeah, it's all up here. I've still got it.
Yeah, him talking about, like, kissing girls in 8th and 9th grade.
Yeah.
You know, that was wild stuff. Him talking about the difference between his life on the different sides of town that he had. Like, it's really wild to read this. And the normalcy of, like, what Prince's childhood and adolescence were like. Like, it sounded a lot like everybody else's.
Yeah.
Except he's Prince.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and even little sly asides, like, fellas, you don't need Debbie's breasts in your hands. You know, he would play with his sexuality in this way that I was surprised by because, you know, he was no longer playing Head and Darling Nikki and all those songs. And I worried that he was going to shy away from that when, of course, his sexuality was such a pivotal part of his persona and his music. So I was really happy that he didn't do that. But then also, when I wrote that personal statement, my first line in it is, when I listen to Prince, I feel like I'm breaking the law. And I was like, oh boy, I really got a good one. You know, I figured it out. And that might have been the single most shocking thing he said to me, was that I got that totally wrong. And he was like, I read that line aloud to him and he just said, let me stop you right there. And I was like, oh no, it's line one and we're already in hot water.
Right.
And he really felt that he wrote music in harmony and that there was nothing law breaking about his music, that it was in accordance with certain of God's laws. And then I would think about a line like the one in It, where he's like, I think about it so much it must be a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, hey, that's like why I wrote that. And it's like, nope, you're wrong. And I love that. He could surprise you just in – I try never to predict what he would say or feel about anything, because almost everything out of his mouth would be a surprise. And anyone who speculates about where he would have come down on something, I think, does so at his own peril, you know?
Yeah, the other, I think, normal part, for lack of a better term, that I found in this is the way you talked about him calling, just be like, hi, Dan, it's Prince.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I guess which he had to do because he was always calling from a different phone number.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. But even, or in Australia, he would be under his pseudonym, Peter Bravestrong. So mm-hmm. It would be like, oh, Peter Bravestrong's calling. He's like, no, it's me. It's Prince. All right, cool. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying.
Like, did he understand that the rest of us are looking at this like this is like what in the world's going on?
Oh, yeah. I really do think he took a very active delight in that, because he was a master showman. He was so self-aware and so canny about the way that he would present himself that I think he knew that even by picking a name like Peter Bravestrong to register at the hotel with, you know, it's like a joke with himself almost. And I think he took a lot of joy in knowing how all this would come across and how it would once reveal and further conceal him.
Now, I'm curious for you about the process of the writing, especially, you know, the early portion that is intensively you in writing that. And you wrote that with Chris Jackson, who is like the editor that if I ever write a book, I'm going to beg.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Like, can you please, like, you edit all the people I want to, you know.
He's the greatest.
How long was it from when you first started writing that till everyone was like, okay, this is good enough to run?
I had to do it very quickly because once we settled on a release date for the book, it was like we really had to move pretty fast. So I think it was almost exactly a year ago that I started it. And, you know, for a long time after he died, I'd really tried to take painstaking notes of all of our time together, but I had not really gone back to them just because I was so sad. And it seemed for a long time like the book was not going to happen. So revisiting all of that stuff really was a deeply emotional experience. And it also jogged my memory. I was like, oh my God, there's so much that happened that I had kind of repressed in a way. So I wrote it over the course of about a month, and I think we had agreed in the beginning that it shouldn't be longer than like 10,000 words, which I think it ended up coming in almost twice as long as that, because I just felt I had to be totally transparent about everything that happened if I wanted people to really understand what Prince wanted and to convey the authority he had invested in me. And Chris was just so great to work with on it. He knew exactly the trouble spots, where I was going on too long, what I needed to bring out more. And we just worked together on, I think, like two or three drafts of it over last January. And by like late January, mid-February, it was finally sitting in a place where I think we were both like, okay, this is ready.
Yeah, how exhausting was it? Because I feel like the book writing process is you write the best thing that you've ever written in your life to have somebody tell you what's not good.
Yeah, yeah. This wasn't really like that because Chris is so supportive. And, he fortunately had lived through a lot of these same experiences that I had, or at least I had been updating him in real time. So he could really remind me of things that I had forgotten about, and he could kind of inject his own point of view one time. I think at one point he left a comment in the document at the point where we're talking about the contractual process with the publisher, which Prince had very specific ideas about, as you can imagine. And Chris told the story about how Prince had called him and said, like, hey, maybe we can just do the book without a contract. And he was like, I would love to do that, but then Random House can't pay you. And he's like, okay, I'll call you back. And I was like, that's got to go in. That has to go in. And Chris was like, yeah, it should go in.
I'll call you back.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love that. He also called his agent, Esther Newberg, at one point during this process. I don't think this is in the book. And Esther was watching college basketball. It was March Madness. I forget the game. But Prince got her on her phone, I think, like out in the Hamptons. He really had to try to reach her. And she was like, yeah, I'm going to have to call you back. The game's on. And he loved that. He loved that he had taken so much effort to reach this woman. And she was like, I can't talk to you now. Yeah, little things like that are just so delightful.
Now, would you say, because he definitely, you know, it sounds like he gave you lots of details about what was going on in these times and what you talked about. Would you say that you felt like he let you in? Because it still sounds like there were some barriers.
Yes. Yeah, there absolutely were barriers. He could be very open. And I think there was a way that he was letting me in a way that he had maybe not let a journalist or writer in before, to be sure. But he could always kind of keep you at arm's length. And it would be funny to see over the course of a single conversation how he could kind of go back and forth like that. I remember feeling this intimacy with him at certain moments. We would be laughing together almost conspiratorially about how weird this book was going to be, all the different ways we could make it unlike anything that had been published before. And then in the next moment, you know, the arm would kind of come out and push me back a little bit. And I would be like, oh, right. Like, I don't know this man very well. So, yeah, I would never want people to think that we were totally simpatico or that I was like a Prince whisperer who got inside his head. It didn't happen. I'm very lucky that he shared with me the things he did. I think those were really personal for him, and I like to think it would have kept going. But, yeah, the mystery remains intact.
Is there any one thing that you wanted to get to in talking to him? Because we had a whole life to discuss, obviously.
Yeah.
One thing that jumps out that you didn't get to talk to him about.
Oh, my God. So many things. I mean, we were just on the cusp of getting to his proper musical career. And I wanted to know, I'm a drummer. I really wanted to know how he had gotten into drum machines and how he had learned to program them so well. And
better than everybody else.
Yeah. And to make them sound human. Because part of the reason growing up I never really listened to Prince, other than that I was a loser, was that I would be like, well, I'm a drummer and drum machines are for, you know, that's not real. And he makes them sound like they're not machines. I mean, they have that kind of frostiness to them just in and of their very nature, but he makes them sound warm at the same time, and you can kind of hear the human hand programming them. And no one that I know of was doing anything like that at that time. I mean, maybe like craft work or something. So I really wanted to talk to him about that and just about his kind of musical regimen generally. Like, part of the point he wanted to make with the book was that he did not emerge from a vacuum and that he wasn't magical. You know, he hated that word magical, or not hated. He would never use the word hate either. But he had preferred not to be referred to as magical. And that's because he put so much work into becoming who he was. And I really wanted to drill down more into that work.
I also bet that part of why he ain't want to be called magical is that's the kind of thing you say about short people.
Yeah.
Right, right. Like, it takes them to an elfin place.
Yes, it's inherently condescending.
Yeah, like when you really think about that, nobody thinks about somebody being 6'5 and magical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Only Magic Johnson. That's how good Magic Johnson was. Yeah. He was 6'9 and people thought he was magic.
Yeah.
Like, otherwise, we assume that it is our elfin homies that possess all these talents.
Yeah, yeah. Like, oh, he's so magical.
Yes.
You could just put him in your pocket.
Yes.
Yeah, no. He didn't want that.
The thing about the drum machines, like, you know, shout out to all you guys who aren't really Prince fans because I'm about to get nerdy on it.
Nuts.
The ill thing about the Black Album
is
that even the tracks that are intended, like the tracks that are obviously intended to mock rap.
Yes.
The drum programming is as good as anybody was doing in 1986 or 87.
I know. And like LaGrind and right. Cindy C and all that stuff. I mean, those are just funk masterpieces and they're built on machinery. It's nuts.
The thing that I wanted to get to, because this is an interesting path in the books I'd read right before I got to this, right?
Yeah.
So Morris Day's memoir came out. And shout out to Morris for being self-aware enough to know that we weren't trying to read a book about him. We were trying to read a book about Prince, and he gave us a book about Prince.
He did.
Yes, it's actually very much so worth reading, because I was actually kind of like, man, I can't buy this man's book to eavesdrop on somebody else.
Yeah.
But it's really about his journey with Prince.
I totally agree. Yeah. And I remember hearing that he was going to have Prince's voice in it, and
yes.
I was like, well, I don't know about that. And then I was like, wait, Prince told me that he wanted our voices to blend in his book. So why shouldn't someone else try to do that? Someone who certainly knew him much better than I did.
Morris knew what we were here for, man, right?
Yeah.
Like this. Yeah. Basically what Morris gave us was like a concert with a Prince hologram. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he was aware that that's what we wanted. So then after that, I went to Rick James' autobiography.
Oh, yeah.
Which is... the only reason it's not a movie is because nobody will believe it's true. It is mind-blowing everything that happens. But then I go from there and his distaste for Prince, right? And,
And Morris, they really had it out.
Morris was not mean to Prince. Morris did not sound like he had any problem with Prince, but it is not necessarily the most flattering portrayal of him in the book, right? Some of the more selfish moments that he could have and stuff like that. And then you get to Rick, who just absolutely hates him. And I really wanted to get to the part of the Rolling Stones tour and the Rick James tour, like Prince's opening act and what the challenges were on those. Because one thing about Rick, as I tell you about Rick's autobiography, I found fascinating. He admitted to doing a lot of horrible things. He could not bring himself to mention the fact that he used to date Vanity and then Prince showed up and then Vanity turned up with Prince.
That's right.
Right. He mentions that, the Vanity 6 concept is something that he had come up with, and that was the plan. He never once mentions that Vanity, that whole thing happened. So then I get into this with the Prince book, and I was just like, man, it would be so great if we could. That early portion, the superstardom level Prince, I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But really, like, the 78 to 82 is what I'm really curious about.
Yeah, me too. Recording Dirty Mind and all of that in a studio that I think apparently would, like, flood and stuff.
Yes.
That seems – and to look at those handwritten lyrics from that period, which he has in this gorgeous kind of terrifying red ink, it's like he knew. He knew what he was trying to bottle at that point. And the Black Album, too, as you mentioned, the whole story of shelving that and this kind of love, sexy mythology that came out of that with Spooky Electric and Camille. And there was that one night where apparently Prince really had that epiphany and was like, I can't release the Black Album. It is satanic.
Yes.
And I could not wait to talk to him about that stuff. And also, as you say, the part of him that shows up more in Morris's book. Like, I think he must have known that he had been a jerk to some people, and I wondered how he would handle that in his own writing.
Right. And then there's the slave portion. Because one thing I don't get the feeling about with Prince is that he does that much of, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
I don't get that vibe that's the way that he looks at these things that have happened. I do wonder, though, 20 years removed from the slave thing, if you look back and you're like, maybe a little much.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I wonder about that, too. He did say to me in our last conversation, this kind of surprised me, too. He was talking about how we should pace the book and how Purple Rain was paced so that you would never dwell on one scene too long before the music was front and center. And he was like, because a lot of times the acting wasn't that great. And I was like, there was a time where I don't think he would have ever admitted that. And I think he was very kind of real about everything that had happened in the 80s, which just makes me wonder so much more about what else he would have said.
So what's your favorite Prince album?
Oh, God, I can't pick a favorite.
You can't pick what?
Yeah, I mean, everything really from For You all the way through Love Sexy is like 5 stars for me. Or maybe even through like Diamonds and Pearls.
I could say, let me think. I think that I used to be one of those Sign of the Times is the magnum opus that he did. And then I realized, and I'm a bit of a music critic, and then I realized that that's kind of music critic trying to be cute, right? Like the best of these is Purple Rain. Like the answer, it's this fast. That was another thing I wanted to get more into. And I noticed in some of the, and for those who haven't seen the book, there's a lot of handwritten lyrics and just kind of, ruminations through time and explanations, quotes from previous publications to explain a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Or Purple Rain is a hard rock gospel album, right? Like when you really get to the nuts and bolts of it, and it is a guitar masterpiece. It is the start to finish. Oh my God. guitar masterpiece. Like, I think then I go to like Sign of the Times and Dirty Mind 1999.
Yeah.
Which are so fun to listen to back to back, even though controversy is in between. Like, those two are so fun to listen to back to back.
Yeah, yeah. They're in conversation with each other.
Right. It's like, okay, this is kind of what I'm trying to do and how I'm trying to get it here. And now I'm going to do it with the drum machine. Like, I'm going to unleash the drum machine on the world.
Yes.
None of us are ready for this, right?
No. Yeah.
There's no way. It's a double album with 11 songs.
Yeah. And I'm so excited for that reissue that's coming out.
Yes.
And to finally have some of these bootlegs that I've been listening to for years with that tape hiss in them, to have clean versions of those.
Yeah. When the Napster thing jumped off, and see, this is where, you know, I'm a little older, therefore I could be like, you know, like the Napster thing happened when I was in college.
Yeah. And so I was in high school. Yeah.
But the thing with Napster that I think gets forgotten is that for that period of time, everybody went there. So that meant that every song that anybody had on the internet at that time was in that place. Like, there are things that you could find on Napster that you still can't find anywhere else because there aren't enough people sharing the file, you know, or anything
else. Yeah, and it's fractured. But you're like, Napster was the sort of centralized piracy hub.
And so had the greatest collection ever, and the download speeds were better. So, like, some of those Miles Davis on New Year's Eve at Paisley Park, I was like, cool, I'm able to get some of these, right?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of live stuff I was able to get. Like, it's a medley of Slow Love, Adore, Jackie Wolf, Sister, something else, like in an 8-minute spin that comes back at the end with Adore. Like, all those things were there that you couldn't, now it's just almost impossible to find until the estate decides to give it to us. Yeah. And I have to say, the estate has been better at putting this stuff out than I expected.
Oh, completely. Yeah. I think they've really found their footing now. And I think this 1999 reissue is going to be the crown jewel of their offerings so far.
I'm here for it.
Me too.
I'm so here for it. So you said you're a drummer.
Yes.
Prince's drummer is kind of the underrated, I think the underrated thing that he's got.
Completely, completely. I always, once I got the job, I would be like, oh, maybe there's some time where I'll like play drums with him, you know, because your fantasies really go into overdrive. And I always, if I could have gotten a 10-minute drum lesson from him, that would have been great.
I feel like though a drum lesson for Prince, like, yo, I need to start here.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like I feel like Prince would be like, and that's how you play 7-7-7-93-11.
I know. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. You should really, I think you'd want to isolate every part. You'd be like, actually, I don't need a drum lesson. I need just the hi-hat today. Just tell me exactly how to move my foot up so I can get that hiss on the open hats.
So how'd you get into his music?
Well, the first time I remember even seeing a Prince album was in 1999, appropriately, at a Walmart in Maryland, where I grew up, and it was Rave Unto the Joy Fantastic album, and I did not buy it because I was into much music at the time. It was like Limp Bizkit and all that stuff.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
It is. It is. A product of my times, alas. But I remember picking it up and being like, what is this? He was going by the symbol at the time. He's in this like vinyl blue outfit that kind of glitters, and it was almost like bookmark for later. And I was like, I just knew that I couldn't handle it at the time, but I really would look at that album every time I was in Walmart, which was kind of a lot. And then I heard If I Was Your Girlfriend on the radio, like as soon as I got my driver's license, and that's kind of where it all started. I was like, this is haunting, beautiful, deeply intimate, emotional music that's also really funky. And then when I got to college, it was the musicology tour at that time, and I had a friend who had just seen that and was like, you have to get deep into Prince. Like, you really don't have a choice if you claim to be a musician. And I was like, okay, that's fair. And it was sort of a similar thing where people were just passing albums around a lot. There was a lot of downloading going on, and I just got my hands on everything that I could.
Musicology tour was my first Prince concert.
Yeah.
That was my first one. And If I Was Your Girlfriend is like my first favorite Prince song.
Yeah.
I do think, because I'm bad at like superlatives and listing and things like that.
Yeah.
My brain doesn't really work that way. But that is probably the most brilliant thing that he ever did. It is like the line of all lines. Like, if you told me that's the best written song ever made, that anybody ever wrote, if I was your one and only friend, would you run to me if somebody hurt you?
Even if that somebody was me.
Sometimes I trip on how happy we could be. And I'm just like, because I'm not this kind of person, right? Like, this is not like, yo, I relate to that. And I'm like, whoa, that's amazing.
I know. It's such a gorgeous, multi-layered, psychosexual song.
Yeah.
It's, And that monologue at the end in the Camille voice where
holds you tight and holds you long to get you to stare in the silence.
Yes. And the way the synths interplay with that and start that like
yes.
Oh, it's again like the word frosty comes to mind because those synths are so cold, but there's like this beating heart.
And that beating heart is one of the sneakier dope bass lines in the catalog.
Yeah.
It's even a line, right? Right there exactly where you need it. And, you know, half the board's not firing on that.
Yeah.
Susan Rogers, I think her last name is Rogers, the engineer. Yeah, she said half the board wasn't firing. Like, one of the fascinating things about Prince is, and I saw her describe this in an interview, he didn't care that much about the details.
Yeah.
He was like, if this is smoking, then all that matters is that it's smoking.
Yes.
And so they realized halfway through recording that half the board was not firing and if I was a girlfriend. And he heard it and was like, oh, this is great. And then just kept it moving.
Yeah.
Because that's how smoking this is. I don't even need the whole board.
Yeah. It's right. It affects the sound of it somehow. Like that slap is almost like muted and rubbery. It's like, ugh.
Yeah. My brother and sister, so I'm 39. My sister, she will be 49 soon, and my brother is 52. And so they are, like, of the contemporary generation of Prince's music. And so it just kind of got passed down to me. And then at the point, like, I'd always really been into it. And then when I decided I wanted to be a music critic is when I just got, like, super duper into it. And I'm becoming an adult, so this stuff is actually making a little more sense.
Right.
And so now, like, going back, like, when I went back and listened to Dirty Mind, because I think Dirty Mind's one... It's critically acclaimed, and people who really dig Prince dig it. It's not necessarily the easiest one to pass on to somebody because it's not what they think it's going to be.
Right.
But it is genius. And it just, you know, I just put out my demo tape. Like, it's the demos. These are all demos.
Yeah. I mean, even a song like Do It All Night, which I don't even think was ever a single.
I love that one.
Like, yeah.
The he might do something to you that you like.
Yeah.
Is the line for that where I'm like, oh, wow, that's some real vulnerable right there, when you say someone over there said he wants to get to know you, I don't care because I really want to hold you, and I'm scared because he might do something to you that you like.
Yeah,
wow.
And the guitar turnarounds in that—you can almost hear his hand just like just going nuts over the guitar. Just bam, bam.
Yeah, I don't know. I have found myself that since he died, I have revisited some of the post 92 stuff. And it's like when you separate it from the times, because he was trying so hard to find his place in the game.
Yeah.
When you hear this at this point and you can separate it from everything else that was out, it becomes a lot more interesting.
It does.
Right? Because at the time it was just like, yo, this is not what we're doing right now.
Right, right. Yeah. But Diamonds and Pearls and Emancipation, the Gold Experience.
I like Gold Experience a lot.
Yeah, yeah. That, I mean, yeah, some of the kind of, I don't know if it's like modal, but like the synth work on a Endorphin Machine or something. Yeah, that's, no one was doing anything like that then.
Mm-mm. No, it's all, like the Rainbow Children's fun to go back to just because it's so Witness though. And that was the other thing too, because you know, I kind of blame Larry Graham for interfering with our fun a little bit. And not that Prince didn't put out some heat after, and he's probably too old to still be doing that other stuff anyway.
Sure.
But Larry Graham did not make anything better by inviting Jehovah into the crib.
Yeah, I mean, it's
like we were good.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody was over here having a great time.
Yeah.
And you had to come in with this. Like how did this happen? And I'd love to hear about Prince knocking on doors because apparently he knocked on doors.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, and he had that whole L.A. sojourn where I think he would be in some very Tony California neighborhoods really saying hello.
Just imagine opening the door and it's Prince. And you're like, oh my God, it's Prince. Except it's also Prince passing me religious paraphernalia that I don't want to talk to him about, but I feel like I should let him. Like, I bet he probably had the longest, like, the stretch of his ability to get in the house and actually talk to people. I imagine it greatly exceeded anybody else.
If they keep stats on that, he's gotta be number one. I mean, he's the only one who could have converted me, I think.
Like, everybody else is making this run through the neighborhood in 15 minutes because nobody's answering the door. Three hours later, Prince hadn't gotten off the block.
Yeah. And somehow given away his entire stash of watchtowers.
Yes, I just don't have any left.
Yeah.
Right? Prince has got to bring a stack. Yeah. I did read something once that said that Prince was doing it in Minneapolis during football season. He's coming around on Sundays.
Yeah.
And like, yo, man, you know better than this, right? Yeah. Like, you're going to need to change your approach.
Yeah.
Just slightly. So how's this feel for you, man, now that this is out?
It feels great. I mean, there is a kind of sadness with it too, of course, because it's been so many years in the making. And as I said earlier, I thought it wasn't going to happen for a long time. So I'm elated that it's out, but it feels like the end of something that I've been working toward for a long, long time. And, you know, I respect people who are like, I don't know if this should ever have been released and all that. But after he died and I had those memoir pages in my possession and I would just read them and reread them, I would think like these have to see the light of day somehow. And I would hear from the fans every day. They'd be like, when are you going to release them? When are you going to release them? So I'm just so happy that they're out there. Of course, I wish there were more of them. And they, you know, people call it an unfinished memoir. It's really, it's a barely started memoir. That's a hard thing to put out into the world. And anyone who raises their eyebrows at it, I totally understand. But he was such a beautiful man. I had to do right by him as best I could.
How did it feel that first moment that you had that hardcover in your hand? Like not a galley, not an improved, the actual book.
It was at the random, it was in Chris Jackson's office actually, and he was away at the time. So his great assistant Cecil just like put one in my hands, and I felt like it was going to disappear the second I put it down. It's such a beautiful object. I mean, they did such a great job, and it has this weight to it. And I was like, oh my God, it's even better than I would have imagined. And I managed to keep it together there, but basically as soon as I was on the subway, just knowing that it was in my bag and then I couldn't show it to anyone, like the tears began to fall.
Yo, you're better than me, because I'd have been on that train like, this me.
Yeah.
This me. I'd have gone down to every single person. I'd have been like, this.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. I am this. I'm with. That's who I am. Yeah. I am with. I would not have been able to keep that. Whoa, boy.
Knocking on the conductor's window.
Yeah.
Can we stop the train, actually? I have an announcement.
Yeah. You know what? I bet you would have walked out and gotten all the handshakes and applause and everything else, because everybody there would have understood just how cool this was. I do not know you. I just met you when you walked in here today. But I sincerely hope for you that there is never a point that you do not, like, that you, it's going to be easy to do in this game, to lose sight of. This is some of the coolest shit in the world that anybody has ever been able to pull off, right? Like I say, I don't know you, and I'm looking at you like, yo, good for you, man.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah. I still can't really believe it. I mean, the whole 3-month period that I was with him now really feels like a dream. The fact that the estate came through and let us put this out, and that he had kept so much that really did resonate on the same things we had talked about. Like, it's just, there are so many points along the way where it could have been just an utter disaster. And I'm so proud of it. And I wish he were here to experience it.
Now, what's the situation with, you said you were about to go on tour?
Well, I've already sort of been on it a little bit. I just got back from London and, had to do all these, like, British morning shows, which is kind of a hoot, because it felt like it was like 1 a.m. for me. And
right.
I'm like, yeah, Prince is cool. And they're like, oh, very good. I still got to go to Canada, but we have this great event on Monday for the book on the 18th, where Spike Lee is going to moderate a conversation between Chris and I, which is going to be so fun. And the New Power Generation is going to be there. So I hope I can hear some of those songs we just talked about.
I really
want him to play Live for Love on Diamonds and Pearls. That's like this such a proggy number.
Yeah.
It's like Prince's prog rock epic.
I feel like you should be able to make requests.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like you're at the point now where you are the vessel and vehicle through which the story gets out. I feel like you should get to make a request.
Cool. Well, maybe I should let it be known that I need to live for love. Yeah.
And then, you know, so what the hell are you supposed to do next?
Yeah, I have no idea. That's the question that everyone asks me, and I'm like, haha, I gotta go.
Yeah, if I say, I tried to ask that as facetiously as possible, because I know that this is like, I would have no idea what the next thing is. Like, what am I supposed to be happy doing after this one?
Yeah. I mean, I love collaborating. The whole process, as far as that's concerned, has always been good, because writing is, as you well know, is such a solitary activity, and just to have someone to call up on the phone, or even after Prince died, like his music to listen to and something to kind of push back against and to feel pushing back on me, makes it a lot easier. So I do want to keep doing that in some way, but I also know I should, try to write my own book, and I have no idea what that would be. So fortunately, I've still got a few weeks where I can just think about it and not have to make any moves, but to see.
And now are you at the point now where you're starting to like get to meet cool people based on this?
Well, I mean, yeah, getting to meet Spike Lee, just that was fantastic. Went to his production studio in Fort Greene and just had such a wonderful talk with him. And now he's going to do this event. But yeah, even just getting to intersect with people who worked with Prince, who are just huge fans of his. Like, I was really worried that that would be a bit much, and it's actually been this really nourishing thing. I mean, just to talk to people like you who really have steeped themselves in his music and know everything and are just so moved by him as I was moved by him. It's been great.
All right, man. Dan, Pipe and Brain. Got it right?
That's right. Got it right.
All right. I feel good about that. Check out The Beautiful Ones, Prince's memoir. Dan is the co-author and is put in the book. Shout out to Prince. 50-50 split.
Yeah.
And I love the idea that he called you and was like, look, but we're going to get this 50-50. Like,
yeah, he was so canny about all that contractual stuff. He's really, he's like, you and I need to co-own the book, and I'm not counting your money, and you're not counting mine, and all that stuff. Oh, I miss him.
Hey, man, check out the book. It's a must-have for the Prince-ophiles, and also just worth checking out if Prince is something that you're vaguely familiar with. I recommend that you check that out. And ladies and gentlemen, I thank you so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Be sure to check out The Bill Barnwell Show. His guest is Mina Kimes, who does not bring her dog, and they will be talking about Seahawks Niners. Be sure to subscribe to Bill Barnwell Show. Also, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And I'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.